This is the second conversation with Dr. Kenneth Clark. Dr. Clark, tell me what you mean by the word race. What is the nature of this concept?
Well, the word race is one of those ambiguous terms that man uses, and it is difficult to define it with any degree of precision. In fact, it seems to me that it is one of those terms in which its very ambiguity is the basis of controversy and confusion and conflict. I suspect that if we really knew exactly what this term meant, we would not have all the problems and the difficulties that we seem to have in dealing with
it. Here we have cases which are, give us objective points of reference.
Mm-hmm.
We have Indians, Chinese,
yes.
Africans, West European,
yes.
Caucasians, where we meet to see a big difference. And we then have the laws of Virginia,
yes.
where gradually the definition has been narrowed down to over the years to a mathematical infinity of a small percentage. A presumed percentage of Negro blood.
Yes.
What's going on?
All right. As far as I know, anthropologists and biologists have not been able to agree even among themselves as to a precise definition of this term, race. It is obvious, of course, that human beings do differ in many physical characteristics, such as skin color, average height, or hair texture, shape of head, and other observable and measurable characteristics. The term race is usually associated with one of these more obvious characteristics, such as skin color. There have been attempts, as you know, to classify human beings on the basis of the varying gradations of skin color or the amount of melanin in the skin. This particular factor seems associated with some other characteristics, such as hair texture, but not always. For example, the Australian Aborigine, the natives of Australia, are very dark in skin color, but do not have the same hair texture as the dark Africans or some sub-Saharan Africans.
And don't the Africans differ in hair texture a great deal from one part of Africa to another?
Africans differ in skin color
too,
a great deal.
Yes.
For example, the Ethiopian Africans, and Ethiopians are Africans, they're on the continent of Africa, have a hair texture that is not unlike the hair texture of Indians or Caucasians, but have gradations of skin color that match the skin color of sub-Saharan Africans who have a different hair texture. Egyptian Africans have gradations of skin color that overlap skin color of southern Europeans and with general hair texture.
You have hair texture in parts of continental Europe that is very similar to hair texture, you say, is African, of course.
That's right. So human beings vary. There's no question about it. The fact that groups of human beings vary in physical characteristics, and there is some tendency for the variations in some characteristics to be accompanied by variations in other characteristics, but this is not always consistent. I think
psychological differences. This point.
I'm still talking about physical because I do not think that the question or the issue of race can be meaningfully discussed in terms of psychological or behavioral characteristics. I think that the issue of race, if we are seeking any kind of precise definition of race, must start with establishing some kind of consistency in physical characteristics or differences in physical characteristics. And even here we see that we have problems and difficulties that the layman is not always sensitive to. I mean, I think if you ask the average person about race, he would be sure that the white man whom he knows is not only white in skin color, but has these and these and these and these other physical characteristics, and is not likely to entertain the possibility that you might find people who are white in skin color, but with different hair texture, or different eyes, or with different shapes of head, etc.
Let me ask a question that cuts across this, but I hope it's not a diversion.
Mm-hmm.
What about the fact of the change of physical measurements and other physical qualities on the American continent within our time, within, say, the Americans in 1776? All races have changed on coming to the American continent.
Well, yeah, actually, races, Franz Boas has shown that groups from Europe tend to change their physical characteristics as they migrate to America without interbreeding.
Without interbreeding,
just the changes in the in the geography.
At least they are 3 inches taller.
That's right.
So are the Americans in 50 years, an inch taller.
So you do seem to have some evidence which suggests modification in these physical characteristics in terms of changes in environment. You also have the fact that groups of human beings have been interbreeding for long periods of time, so you do not have, or at least in terms of some of the authorities that I depended upon when I was a graduate student in sense, you cannot find very many places in the world where there has been intercommunication among human beings, examples of, quote, pure races. Where you do find such examples, they're generally in places in the world that have been isolated from normal intercommunication contacts with other peoples. For example, I think maybe one of the best examples of pure racial types are the Australian Aborigines, who were, in a sense, the evidence is that they were isolated from the mainstreams of communication and contact and transportation with other peoples for centuries and centuries. They were Stone Age people, really. And the Negritos seem to be pure types. But other groups of human beings seem to reflect a tremendous amount of intermingling that has been going on long periods of time, you see.
Well, now, this is a scientific perspective, a historic perspective on the question. We have to relate this to the rule of thumb, common sense, quote, notion of physical difference as we find it in social collision.
Well, that's another approach to race.
How do we relate these now?
Well, actually, they're not necessarily related, interestingly enough. I think that what groups of human beings have done was to use certain observable differences among human beings as a basis for establishing distinctions and differential status and hierarchy among human beings. But this has been done not only on the basis of, quote, race or color differences. They have been done on the basis of religious differences. They have been done on the basis of political differences, ideological differences. And one of the most persistent ways in which human beings have established not only distinctions, but hostile distinctions among group of human beings in terms of military power, conquests, and submission, you see. Now, in America, race has been defined primarily in terms of class and caste and status distinctions, so that a person is a Negro in America if he is treated as a Negro.
The status distinction, then, you take as key. Is that right?
Key to the use of the term race in the American context.
The American context.
That's right.
This leads to another question. is Asia. In medieval Europe, the blood sense of difference between, say, the aristocracy and the peasantry was almost an absolute distinction in a blood sense.
Right.
More absolute, probably, in certain contexts anyway, even in a blood sense in, just in America now, between white and Negro.
The fact that hemophilia is an aristocratic disease in Europe, tending to reflect inbreeding in, among those individuals. I don't think that there is any evidence of a blood distinction in race in America, for one reason, because Negroes and whites have intermingled so much in America since slavery. There are very few pure Negroes in America.
Yes, the complexion remains as a rule of thumb distinction.
To the extent that very fair, light-skinned Negroes have passed over, tend to pass over into the white
spectrum.
That's right. Actually, even within the visible colored peoples of America, you have evidence of a great deal of mixture. I mean, Indian, white, and African or Negro. You just can't call the American Negroes a race in any strict sense, or if you're talking about race in terms of pure biological stock. I mean, the American Negroes are mixtures of at least three.
Let's take that. Then what about the just visibility as a factor? Just the fact of difference in complexion.
Well, those who are visible are visible.
Are visible, obviously.
And those who are not visible, a large proportion of Negroes who are defined, say, as having had some Negro ancestry, who were not visibly Negroes, tend to go back into the white status groups and live as white, be treated as white, marry as white, and have children as white. You think?
Dr. Clark, we have three perspectives then, don't we? We have the whatever is a scientific concept of race,
which is extremely difficult to anchor.
Whatever it is.
That's right.
We have then visibility.
Visibility, yeah.
And then we have some definition, which we can go to Virginia statutes, the determinants of Virginia.
Status.
Which is, it's not put on status, it's put on the matter of some infusion of Negro blood.
But that obviously makes no sense, except in terms of status, and a statutory determination of status distinction.
I'll put this with the status. It's a statutory determination of status. It's a very mixed and muddled thing, because the person might be by any possible definition of status outside the definition of status involved.
But the attempt on the part of the state or the instrument of government to fix the status of this individual in terms of their definition of his race.
Now we have three perspectives. Mm-hmm. What is the moral of this fact? I don't know what the moral is.
Race is used in America as one of the, and a very convenient pretext by which a group of human beings who have power or believe they have power seek to arrogate the power onto themselves and restrict the extent of power or status for others, you see.
That how is race used in Africa as a concept?
Well, I think that the conflict between the Europeans and the Africans was one in which race as a visible and historical, quotes, reality, became associated with a status reality when the Europeans were in control and in power. In Africa, they subordinated the Africans to their control, in spite of the fact that the Europeans were a numerical minority. Now the Africans are insisting upon reverting or reversing this pattern, or if not reversing it, changing it so that they they will assume the power and the control in their own land, you see. And there is some evidence that some of the new African nations are not going to settle just for taking back control and power, but they are even suggesting some type of subordination of life.
Gas channel.
I haven't heard that.
It's a projection of a possibility, isn't it?
Well, what does bother me about Africa is the future in terms of South Africa. And what is likely to happen there if the South African picture continues to develop in the very negative way that it seems to be going within South Africa and between South Africa and a group of independent black African states to the north. This is a basis for a great deal of anxiety for those of us who even dare to think about it.
I don't want to think about it.
I don't want to think about it either, because I
don't want to think about that one. Cutting back to the Watusi Bastards and their traditional superiority, which is now making big trouble in the Congo, how much do the Watusi feel themselves racially different from the subject tribes?
I don't know whether they put it on the basis of race. They certainly put it on the basis of...
They look different.
They look different. These are tall.
Tall, thin, long, thin skulls.
That's right. And with physiognomy that is not unlike the European in terms of sharp features, etc. Thin lips. Different from the other many of the other sub-Saharan Africans. Certainly there is a distinction that these people see between themselves and other Africans. But within Africa, you have distinctions among the sub-Saharan Africans based upon tribe.
Sure.
Tribal differences.
Sure. I'll just think about an acute situation that we read about in the newspapers. But this race, according to the National Geographic newsreels, is more different from its traditionally subject tribes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difference you can find between, say, any race,
right,
by measurements and this, that, and the other.
Quite true.
And color. And a ferocious sense of superiority.
Yes, which is not unique.
Unique.
This is seen to be a peculiar human characteristic to try to find some basis upon which to justify a sense of superiority and difference from other human beings.
What about the
they're like the Germans, aren't they? You know, psychologically.
Well, they were a master race.
Yes.
What about
the ancient Jews who saw themselves as a master race, a chosen people? I think it was Bertrand Russell who said, in his usual succinct way, you know, that man will find or invent any pretext to justify his belief that he's superior to other men.
I'm afraid he's right.
Yes.
Getting on the matter of race, back in African times, how much did the kingdom of Dahomey feel itself as racially distinct in its slave raids?
Well, obviously... He didn't feel identification.
Clearly not.
I mean, I often said that the one thing I wanted to thank Shambi for during the Congo crisis was that he reminded me that slavery would not have been possible if Africans didn't sell their fellow Africans. I think your line of questioning is opening up the realization that cruelty, oppression, blindness, insensitivity, arbitrary use of power, and the subjugation of other human beings is not restricted to white Europeans. That this is unfortunately a pretty common human affliction.
A Negro friend of mine back in the late 30s, looking back on the Ethiopian War, said, "I feel myself split in all directions about this war."
Yeah.
The Ethiopians are slave holders and slave traders.
Of course. Well, look at Liberia. We talked a moment ago about not wanting to look at South Africa. Many of us really don't want to look at Liberia or Haiti or certain parts of India. No, you're quite right, Mr. Warren. Human injustice, insensitivity, and cruelty and barbarity seem unfortunately all too universal.
I don't want to nag at this. You see, of course, what I'm driving.
I'm disturbed at the line of questioning because while it is true and all too true, like most truths, it's double-edged in the sense that it could also be a kind of a truth that could be used for rationalization for our own variety of cruelty, and this we would not want. I know you wouldn't want it, and I certainly
don't. No, I'm not. Let's try to keep it clean.
Yes, all right.
But look at these facts. If I read in a book by Lomax saying the white man went to Africa to seize slaves.
Yes. Wasn't only the white man who profited from the slave trade. You're quite right.
To seize. Who seized the slave?
Wasn't the white man.
The white man didn't seize them.
No.
My point is, I said, let's keep it clean. We're getting back to really...
You mean let us try to get to the difficult and hard truths
the
here?
The difficult and hard truths, you see, that are the psychological and historical facts.
But if you do that, where do you go from there?
I say we have to try to find out.
Don't we constrict our perspective of truth in order not to wallow in just a sense of hopelessness?
Do we really think that? I should say we'd have to bring out all the facts and then try to start again. If I read someone saying the white man went to Africa and seized the slaves, this is so arrogantly unhistorical.
Well, don't you listen to Mr. Malcolm X and Mr. Elijah Muhammad? They say that white men are devils.
White men are devils.
And that we can't have anything to do with them. Negroes can't have anything to do with them because they'll be contaminated by the inherent deviltry of the whites, you see. Well, now let's face it. Mr. X has a following of a sort. You know, this is a kind of oversimplification that... make some kind of contact and appeal. This is the same kind of thing that the white racists are saying to their compatriots and having, mobilizing feelings and keeping people fighting to the death to keep their schools white.
All right. Now, I would say that Malcolm X, Minister Malcolm X, should read Richard Burton's Visit to Dahomey. That's an interesting and elaborate.
Mr. Malcolm would say to you, he said, "This
written
is perverse.
By a white man.
This
yes.
is written by a white man who perverts the truth and
All
actually."
Right. Well, what I'm really getting at is this: Now, if we are going to talk about a question, not a statement, mind you, about Negro history, doesn't the Negro have to take the burden of his history in the same way the white man does?
But does the white man take the total burden of his history?
Well, I'm told I should anyway.
No, don't.
I think a little bit.
Don't even white objective scholars such as Charles Beard write about the Civil War in ways that are more palatable to the conscience and to the positive self-image.
Let's take the Civil War. Let's nag that a little bit. What do you think of Lincoln?
What do I think of Lincoln?
Yes. How do you feel about Lincoln? Now, they marched on Washington, they wound up at Lincoln's monument.
Yeah.
Now, how do you feel about that?
Oh, gracious.
Let's go deep on this one.
I can only answer personally. What do
That's
I think
what
of
I want.
Lincoln?
What
I think
I want.
That Lincoln was a very tortured, troubled man whose greatness was in the honesty in which he not only faced his conflicts and his difficulties, but also sought the most practical accommodations of them.
What were his difficulties and problems?
I think they were there were on many levels. Of course, no man could be as great as he without deep personal difficulties and problems. I think.
But as an aside, what do you think they were for Lincoln? Just on a psychological.
The personal
side,
one.
Just a psychological profile of Lincoln. How would you?
Frankly, I'm not a Lincoln scholar, but just off the top of my head, I think that one of the deep disturbances of Mr. Lincoln might have been his background. The very thing that we now deify in our history books might have been a source of deep feelings of inferiority and anxiety on the part of this man, that he did come from rather humble and obscure and ambiguous background.
And he had a faint vision of an aristocratic ancestry on one side, too.
That's right. But I think that was more compensatory. What was real for Mr. Lincoln was the humble and, questionable background. And also, I think, this is something that human beings rarely bring into consciousness or into parlor discussions. I mean, the role of...
Pause, go on.
The real role of physical appearance, attractiveness or ugliness in a person's self-image. Obviously, Mr. Lincoln was not an attractive person, except in retrospect, you see. Or if
he was terribly strong, physically.
Tall.
He could pick up a barrel of whiskey and put it on the counter.
All right.
That's pretty strong.
Mr. Lincoln, if you exclude the power which came with his office, was certainly not the kind of man that women would flock to or something of that sort. You know, he was homely. He was, and probably in his own inner recesses, exaggerated the negative within him. You see.
He was a man who was a success in his own small scale, you see, if in the beginning. A man of great physical power and a man of sense of mission. Mission being undefined.
Yes.
Aren't those things that would appeal to women?
I don't know. And as you said, we were just speculating.
Guessing.
I think that the kind of domestic problems that Mr. Lincoln had were not only to be understood in terms of the problems of his...
He was a bad wife picker anyway.
That's right. He was clearly a bad wife picker, and he was a sufferer in this regard. But the other thing I'd like to come to about Lincoln, though, is beyond the personal.
Let's get to race.
Yeah, race. Unquestionably, Mr. Lincoln was afflicted by the American schizophrenia. You see, the conflict between the ethics, the ethos, the ideology, what Gunnar Myrdal calls the American creed.
Did Lincoln ever worry about the ethics of it, or just take it for granted?
Well, frankly, I think that maybe Lincoln was the type of person to worry. This is what I meant by turmoil.
Where's the document for that? You see, I don't know. I mean, there may be one. I don't know it.
I don't have specific documents. I only have the general picture of the ambivalence or the inconsistencies or the conflicts within this man. You see, that here was a man who, on the one hand, could look and understand slavery for what it really was, ethically, namely human degradation. And on the other hand, could function in terms of the political imperatives and the realities here. Who could say, if I could... Now, this, I think, is... If you ask for documentation, this is fragmentary documentation.
Absolutely.
What kind of inner turmoil and ethical confusion is reflected in this statement? If I could save the Union without freeing a single slave, I would do so. The same man who makes that statement, who also gives evidence of deep sensitivity to the dehumanization that is inherent in slavery, you see. This I call a symptom of the American moral schizophrenia.
Let me ask a question. Suppose he had said, I will free the slaves and to hell with the Union. Now, what would that mean in an overall, overarching...
Frankly, what it would mean is that he would not have been president.
All right. Now,
he would have been a philosopher. He would have been a man preoccupied with social ethics and social morality, and America has never elected such men to the presidency.
What country has?
I don't know. I'm not talking about the other country.
No, we're taking things in political reference, historical reference. Suppose he had said, as Garrison said, the Constitution is a couple with death, you know. To hell with it. No Union. Blow it up. but freedom. But how do you get freedom outside of the mission of union? What kind of problems does this present? Now, that's
believe
that's
me, I am not arguing against
this
the
is not an
theory
argument
of... No, I know. When I said arguing, I didn't mean in terms of controversy as such, but I'm not struggling primarily in terms of an either-or approach to Mr. Lincoln or a deification or a vilification of him. I'm saying that this man is one of our best examples of an inescapable turmoil, conflict, confusion within thinking Americans. I think that, the thing that fascinates me is that I think that one of the best contemporary example of this symptom that Lincoln, I thought, personified is in Mr. Fulbright.
Right.
You see. Here.
He signed the round robin.
I was talking about Fulbright to my class today. We were talking about moral dilemmas. And I said, I see Fulbright as one of the clearest examples of the contemporary version of the American tragedy. Here's a brilliant man. Penetratingly incisive mind and insightful man who has also the courage to make the kind of statement he recently made about the need to re-examine our fixed positions in foreign policy, our need to ventilate our myths and to look at them and get the kind of intellectual flexibility that is consistent with future effectiveness. And he could say this about foreign policy, you see. And anybody who could say that about foreign policy could not possibly be blind about the same kind of imperatives in terms of American racism. But he's shackled. In one sphere, he is not tied to the lowest common denominator of his constituents. In another sphere, he is. I say that this could only lead to terrible inner conflict and turmoil.
This is the end of the first tape of April 15 with Dr. Clark. Continue on tape 2.